also don't care about feminism. Your favorite show is Entourage.
To be honest, when I found out the patriarchy wasn't about horses, I lost interest anyway.
I wonder if I know what you mean.
I wonder if you wonder.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Maximum Film. It's episode 332, and that is a two-count kickout. It's your boy, Ify Whiteaway, in the booth with me are my friends. So let me introduce you to Dams. First up, we have the Christmas Zaddy himself, one of the most stellar, amazing critics in the game, Alonzo Duralde. What's good?
Oh, you. The ads are starting to run. The trailer is out online. Everybody's getting very excited for the next season of Feud. We've had to wait for years. You know, the Betty and Joan one was so great. Now we're finally getting the new one, which is the Capote versus the Swans. And so I'm not usually the kind of critic that runs out and reads the source material before seeing a movie or TV show. But it just happens that I got this book for Christmas of 2022, and it's been sitting on my shelf mocking me. And I took it down and actually powered through it about 2 days because it's real readable and real dishy. The book that this show is based on is called Capote's Women. It's written by Lawrence Lehmer. And, I can see now why the show is billing itself as the original Real Housewives. Because this is about a group of very powerful and rich and, you know, pampered, but also, because it's the mid-century, miserable, wealthy white women in New York City who pretty much ran the table when it came to, like, high society. And how Capote sort of wormed his way into their good graces and then very abruptly got out of them when he told too many tales out of school. Anyway, it's a really fun read. I would highly recommend. I have not seen a second of the show yet except for the trailer. But if you're getting ready for Feud, dig into Capote's Women. It's a lot of fun.
That sounds wonderful. And I'm really disappointed in myself that I don't have a single Real Housewives quote to throw here. Like, that seems like something I would know and be able to tie back to.
Well, none of these women, like, had a recording career or tried to open a restaurant. So they are already the winners in my book.
Yeah, that's fair. That's fair. Good for them.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of good, let me tell you about somebody who's very good. It's the Queen of the Midwest herself, Super Festival programmer, producer, Drea Clark. What is good?
That was so close to... Speaking of mid... Let me bring Drea into the room.
You would never be mid.
Speaking
never.
Of adequate, I love it. Good. What's good for me is going to be name dropping, but in only in our sphere. This last weekend was the nominee brunch for the Spirit Awards, where I was delighted to meet many of our nominated artists. And as I was running across the room because I was so excited, I was like, oh, it's Sammy Birch and Alex Mechanic, who wrote and did Story By for May December.
Nice.
I was like, oh, I'm so excited. And I got there and they were like, hey, Drea, what's up? And I was like, oh, huh? And turns out I programmed their first short film 10 years ago. And look, I did the Q&A at their screening, and I loved it. And I bring it up both because that was such a delightful surprise, and I really love seeing trajectory of indie artists, especially people who start in short film, and to end up in such an incredible place with the first feature like May December is fabulous. But that short was called All You Can Eat, and it is currently all 13 glorious minutes on Vimeo. And I encourage you to check it out, because I do think if you are interested in the art of film or even making film, seeing a trajectory like that can be great of how someone's voice is established. And it is like if Guy Fieri from Diners, Drives, and Dive-Ins had a deep existential crisis while recording that series. It's great and dark and based
Stop
in reality.
Selling.
Right? So it's like, wow. it's their world. So anyway, that was a very fun, and that's good with me.
Ooh, all right. Well, look, we're going to introduce our guests here. Guests here often are amazing guests and very often are great friends. So, of course, it is my good friend, amazing comedian, writer, co-host of Max Fun's own wrestling podcast, Tights and Fights, Danielle Radford. What is good?
Woo-hoo! Yo! up. Give it up for me. Just Yay. Like with this movie we're talking about today, Nepotism. Get on the show because I'm a network co-host.
No way. You were top of the list, girl.
Love this. I've been getting really into playing a lot of more like video games lately. Like, I'm super into games, but just kind of having this winter break, I've had some time to like really get back into gaming. And I plumb forgot that if you own a Switch, you can download for free all of those basically like ROMs of old like Super Nintendo games, and you can just like download those and play a butt ton of them for free. So I've been going through and nerding out not only on old games like Super Mario 3, but also going and playing like, oh, this is the Super Mario All-Stars version of Mario 3. This is, and comparing and contrasting. I'm getting real nerd specific with these. And so that's been really fun. That's been something that's been enjoyable.
If you started levitating when you brought all of that up, yeah. Thank God you're here.
And he's here to yes and you, because I'm like, that's great.
I recognize the word ROM.
Okay. Yeah. I would, you know, I would definitely think Drea would be a Switch haver. Even Alonzo. I feel like I would like a cute little, like a Animal Crossing.
It crossed my mind during the lockdown, just as a thing that would like, it would force me to do like Dance Dance Revolution or something.
Yeah.
But you know, by that point you could not buy one for love or money. So
too
bad. So I had to just sit on my couch all day.
Yes. Okay. Well, we'll look. We'll get you. We'll get you on board. Maybe that's next year's Christmas gift. Everyone gets a Switch. We'll all play. Yeah, we'll all play Mario Kart.
Games are so cozy. They're such cozy games, too. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, if I'm going to get a Mario, it's going to be 3. Did I do that right?
Yeah, Did I land on the right number?
There's 3. There's Mario Maker, where they make custom Mario games. People can, do it based on the era of Mario. The list goes on.
I love it.
There's a whole thing where he turns into a cat, Drea, so I know you'll like
that. Oh, okay. Sign me up for that one.
And I only know this because of the movie. Iffy, what's good?
Yes.
What's good with me is, you know, starting the year off very right. You know, I blew myself away with how I started New Year's Day, which was, in fact, finally changing the stopper in my bathroom, which, like, I know if you look, some of y'all might not know this. That stopper in the bathroom, you think you can just twist it off and pull it out. It seems like that would make sense. That's how you would do it. But no, you got to go behind the pipes, unscrew that, unhook it, pull it up, switch it out, gag at the hair and old throat juice that's left on there, and you throw it in the trash can, and then you put your new Kohler stopper in, you close that up, you clean out your whole laundry room, which hasn't been cleaned since you moved in, and then you realize, oh, this is a laundry room now, not just a area where there's a washer and dryer and nothing else, because you know, now you live with your partner and you have a bunch of stuff and you need storage, and now you're able to put your big pots down there. You're able to do all that.
And you by know? you mean you.
Yes. I mean you, me One, specifically. Yeah. And I'm at my full Stuart Wellington of the West Coast power. I painted a bunch of Warhammer minis. And I am back at the gym, full power. And look, let me tell you, I'm going to say this isn't real advice before I even say these, let these words leave my lips. I'm back on Vyvanse, and you know what Vyvanse is good for? Making you forget that you need to eat. And I got to say, preventing the iffy snack obsession, because I'm someone who will eat, like, if I'm in a writer's room, I am eating every minute. I'm going up for every snack you can think of. With Vyvanse, you simply forget to eat. Why? Because you're finally doing all these projects. Or sometimes you can have days like today where you come downstairs to write and you spend like 3 hours on OnlyFans. But, you know, shout out to all those models who definitely made a whole bunch of money from me. But I did get 3 paragraphs of a comedic essay done. So that's what's good with me.
I mean, just that was real a real Dear Diary entry
thank
there.
Thank you for taking us on it.
Yes. I feel closer to you as a result.
Yeah. Look, today's show, we're going to head into the ring and show everyone what the Iron Claw is all about. I made an Iron Claw, but realized this is an audio podcast. You can't even see it. And then later, we're going to talk about some notable wrestlers turned actors. But first, it's time for Itadick, our movie news segment that's short for Is This Important and Do I Care? And first up, Drea is going to tell us about something.
I am. Everyone is a critic. While accepting an award from New York Film Critics Circle last week, Christopher Nolan shared an anecdote about a time in 2020 when he was doing a Peloton workout and the instructor panned his film during the class. Nolan summarized her comments in a speech, but footage of the diss has since surfaced. Speaking about Tenet, the instructor said, "Anybody seen this shit? Because I need a manual. Seriously, you need to be a neuroscientist to understand. That's 2.5 hours of my life that I want back. Is this important? Do you care?" And I do want to add that the instructor then, since then, put out an apology, invited him to class to criticize her, and said he would enjoy it. Yeah.
Hey, she's not wrong. You know, man, read the room. Like, if you're a Peloton instructor, you don't want to, you know, there's that right. 1 in a million chance that the director of the film is also in that class, but she's not wrong.
Yeah, wasn't that also right after Peloton got huge because they started doing all those Christmas ads? So 100% we were all inside. It was 2020. Everybody was doing Peloton. So it's so funny because it's like when, you know, when you see like a local band or a local comedian and you just know them in their circles and suddenly they blow up. And it's like, oh yeah, you can't make fun of people the way you used to anymore. It's like, sorry, lady, you just got to like keep pumping or whatever, or standing up or sitting down, or I don't know. I can't afford a Peloton. But it seems very fancy.
I appreciated that in her apology, she was like, yeah, don't get me wrong, I still don't like Tenet. But then she mentioned other work of his that she loved. So, like, she, you know, Oppenheimer, she's like, I've seen that twice, and I don't want those 6 hours back. But it is such a funny and specific, like, if I was Chris Nolan on a Peloton during the pandemic, sweating in my, like, gym/office or whatever, and then the absolute the surreal nature of that woman making fun of my movie while that happened would blow my mind.
I saw Chris Nolan hiking at Runyon Canyon once, and I swear to God, he was wearing loafers and dress slacks and a blazer, and there was a woman standing next to him who's like writing down everything he said. This guy did an entire like steep climb, even if it was downhill, walk in the early morning in Los Angeles wearing like office clothes. So I picture him on a Peloton in like, I don't know, a tuxedo. You know, I don't think he owns a sweatpant.
He's the male version of Mariah Carey on the stair climber in her heels.
Yep. Yeah. I would pay to see Chris Nolan's cribs. I would.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. You can. It's Saltburn.
Oh, get in there. Speaking of drains,
it's a family estate. Yeah. Yeah.
Lordy. Okay.
Clean out the drain, Saltburn.
Speaking of movies, the Alamo Drafthouse has announced that they're launching a program that they're calling Alamo Time Capsule for 2024. Throughout the year, the Texas-based cinema chain will be featuring movies from what they're calling 6 of the greatest years in movie history. January and February will feature films from 1999. March and April will have films from 1994, and so on, going back in 5-year increments all the way back to 1974. Is this important? Do you care?
What if we said no?
No.
No.
I leave this program.
No, I'm not interested.
I finally broke down and got a membership to the Alamo, specifically because I went and saw -1 last month there. Mm. And then I was like, well, I'm probably going to go see Iron Claw anyway, so I might as well get the membership. It's like the same thing. It's cheaper. And I got to say, I care because I fell in love with the Alamo, and I didn't think that like I was going to fall that back in love with it, because I've done it before, but I feel like it's like I like the experience now more. I think that I'm a little older, I can appreciate it. I appreciate being able to sit down, have a fish and chip, watch Godzilla, Jaws. It's fantastic. And so these nights, and especially when you consider like what, 99 is the 25th anniversary of like a billion great movies.
Yeah. Every movie.
There's a whole book about that year,
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Brian Rafferty, yeah.
Yeah, I really, really enjoy those curated nights. Plus, the Alamo always does something really special. Like for Iron Claw, for example, they put together, I want to know which mark did this. It was beautiful. Just a collection of a bunch of different wrestling promos, matches, old pizza commercials. It was a delight. So I know that it's going to be curated very well, and I like to have that kind of a curated experience. I'm excited.
I am obviously thrilled about this because, you know, I'm all for more opportunities for people to see classic movies on the big screen. I got to say, though, rather than spending 2 months per anniversary year and ending at 74, part of me would like to have seen them do like 1 month per anniversary year and go back to 1949, you know, because like there is this thing where with certain people, like good luck getting to watch anything made before 1990, like that's ye olden times. But I think that for a lot of people, even my age, who are, you know, interested in this kind of stuff, but when you get to pre-1970, then it becomes a little more teeth pulley. And I think they could have put together a banger selection of like films from 1954 or 1969. But, you know, I'll take it. It's great. I'm glad it's there. But I just, I'm open to them going, you know, tossing the net even further.
Yeah. I agree with you there. You know, we've talked about films that I've seen that go beyond those years, and always coming back was like, did you see this? And I think, as you know, much like Stanley Cups, you know, the thing that's trendy right now is like being like a film nerd. Like that's the new, I think, like in a very ironic way, the new like Marvel is being like really into films. Like I was making fun of somebody who was on a film Twitter and was like, it's very obvious that Saltburn is your first weird film. I was like, okay, cool. And then in the replies was like, I've been wanting to see Mother. I don't know if it's, I was like, you wait, so you ain't even dug into Darren Aronofsky?
Also, if the furthest reach of weird you can imagine in film is Mother, whoo boy, yeah. You have a journey ahead of you.
Gen Z film heads see Rubber. They're gonna yell. They're gonna make TikToks about how film is now bad.
Rubber, introduce him to some Stan Brackage. Yeah. Like, ooh. Get deep.
I know.
Yeah. Thundercrack.
I wonder if those kids seen Gummo. You know, like.
Yeah. Wow.
I wish. Are times I wish there, I could this smell is that a video. Movie. A video podcast in the face that Drea made when the word gummo left my mouth.
I have strong thoughts on gummo. It was identical to Alonzo's. Yeah. We are twin flames in our feelings about gummo.
Okay. Well, you know, speaking of twin flames, let's talk about some twin globes. The Golden Globe ceremony returned last Sunday for the first time since the Hollywood Foreign Press Association was bought by Dick Clark Productions. No relation. Joe Coy hosted. Big movie awards went to Oppenheimer, Poor Things, Anatomy of a Fall, and The Boy and the Heron, while TV honors went primarily to Beef and the Bear, a show that ironically is about a restaurant called The Beef. Barbie won a brand new award for Best Cinematic and Box Office Achievement, and some of our favorite actors earn acting honors, including Emma Stone, Davine Joy Randolph, Lily Gladstone, and Ayo Edebiri. Is this important? Do you care?
I do like the fact that the Golden Globes brought America together in absolutely hating Joe Coy's monologue, which I missed, and I was also not like on socials for this, but all I've been reading now is how like the nation came together to be like, why is this so not funny?
I ironically heard of the Joe Coy stuff while I was at the Comedy Store doing 51st jokes.
Oh, no.
And I only knew because, Ishmael Saeed, who is a member of the big team, my improv team, was in jury duty. So
I was just going to say, I didn't know that was a friend of yours.
Yeah, yeah. Don't worry, he doesn't talk at all. So even if you would have told him that, he would have stared at you in silence. He is the enigmatic member. He's the only non-loud person of our improv group. But yeah, he's doing the, you know, awards tour for jury duty. So I just saw Carl send a text message said, hey, Ishmael, are you at the Golden Globes? I heard Joe Coy is bombing.
So I did not watch the Globes. As you guys know, I've worked them for 11 years and I no longer am. And so I don't need to watch them anymore. Plus I had a lot of awards stuff going. I'm doing the Spirit Awards, which are in like 6 weeks. Got awards up to my eyeballs. No, thank you. I'm okay. What I'll say is I didn't know who was hosting it, but my niece texted me from New York. Are you watching this? Is this intentionally this bad? And I was like, who's hosting? What do you mean? She's like, this is the worst monologue I've ever seen. And I was like, well, you know, you're 21. So how many monologues have you seen? But anyway, I looked it up and then experiencing through the Globes by peeking at Twitter a couple hours later. It's all you could want. And then my friends that were at the show were like, I'm telling you, it's even worse in the room. And you have to have, it's a thankless gig. We've talked about this. Like, there's a reason they asked 1,000 people and they only booked him like a week and a half ago. It is not a fun time. It is not an easy job. And there's also a strange hierarchy at play. You're asked to be making fun of people who all outrank you. So unless you have some sort of credibility, like Ricky Gervais, absolutely toxic, but had like an element of esteem behind him, had sort of The Office. Well,
last year, Gerard Carmichael brilliantly read the HFPA to filth, and that was super entertaining, but apparently not to the HFPA.
Well, you know, and you know, I one thing I love is that Ricky Gervais took no pay for his hosting job, which is why he won the award for comedy album over all those comedians who had a way better album than him. But yeah, no, I have to echo what my friend Jen D'Angelo posted on her stories, which is, you know, there are so many comedians who are actually like fans of cinema and film.
Yes.
And those are never the ones who are picked. It's always like, people like Joe Coy, right? And it's like,
and here's the thing. Everybody knows that, like, with these awards, it's obviously very, again, everyone says it's a thankless job. We all know this. The difference, I think, is why people felt so willing and able to go in on him as hard as they did was because he threw his writers under the bus.
Yes,
if he wouldn't have done that, people would have left him alone. And then also it's like, this is a very specific kind of delivery for these jokes, and you're watching jokes that might have worked if he didn't bail halfway through. And it's, oh, no. So you don't get to like take the parachute out. Like you just get, or like you're getting shot down over a war zone and like you're playing. We go down as men. You finish the joke. You don't bail at the end. And like, you could see it because we've all had that moment on stage where you have that moment where you're like, well, maybe if I hide inside my body, no one will remember I'm telling this thing they hate. And no, because you're still up there. And so I think that people would have been a lot more kind if he wouldn't have been like, you guys like my jokes, it's all the guys in the back fucking suck.
Yeah.
Like, well, we also just went through a huge writer strike.
Yeah.
Like, it's, you know, we're kind of on team solidarity right now.
And he's a WGA member, I think. Didn't he write the movie he was in?
Yeah.
The Easter Sunday. So
the movie he was in that he did a benefit showing for Rick Caruso. That's when I was like, yeah, I'm not jumping in to help this dude out.
Wow. It just gets better.
Yeah, I know. The more you peel back those layers, you're like, all right, okay, cool. Well, on that note, we're gonna take a break, but when we come back, we're stepping in the ring with the Iron Claw.
Hallelujah! Hello, welcome everyone.
Step right up. We're going to heal you. We are the healers, Ross and Carrie.
Yes, yes. You there. You look like you're upset. Come up here.
Yes, you are healed because you've listened to our podcast.
Yes.
Have you been having trouble with demons?
Are you sleeping too much? Too little? Just right?
We have the solution. It is to listen to
Oh No, Ross and Carrie. A show where we examine unusual claims.
We show up so you don't have to. Find us on MaximumFun.org.
We won't actually heal you.
Welcome back to Maximum Film. I'm Yosef Uwadiwe. In the studio with me are
Drea Clark,
Danielle Radford,
Alonzo Duralde.
Today we're talking about a dramatic film based on a true and tragic story. It stars Zac Efron, Harris Dickinson, and Jeremy Allen White, among others, and is directed by Sean Durkin. So Drea, would you mind giving us a brief synopsis of the Iron Claw?
Yes. As you mentioned, it is a fictionalized dramatic accounting of a true and tragic story of the Von Erich family in Texas in the early 80s. The patriarch of the family is a wrestler himself who only makes it so far in his successes, but he does end up buying and running a wrestling ring sportatorium, I believe it is called. He also...
This is delightful.
Sorry.
I love this. This makes me so happy. Keep going.
And he and his wife have a number of sons, all of which end up following him into the sport of wrestling. Yeah, they are primed for greatness, largely because their father completely isolates them, makes them each other's codependent best friends, and their entire world is about wrestling. But they also seem to genuinely love it and love each other. A lot of push-pull of, you know, sort of father expectations and personal agency, and then sprinkled in some troubling mental health developments and, you know, an assortment of addictions. Yes, the Iron Claw. I warned my father going in that it was going to have a bummer ending. The Iron Claw.
Yes.
There's nothing I love more than watching very smart film people have to say words like sportatorium, because the thing that I love is so ridiculous. Oh, every time it happens, it's like, oh, I float. They made Drea Clark say sportatorium.
I love it. It's a perfect word.
It's so great.
If I was going to run that place, I would also call it a sportatorium.
Oh, wrestling is so good.
Listen, I want to say, as the person here who has lived in not one but two states where the governors were wrestlers, I have an appreciation. Jesse the Body Ventura, governor of Minnesota, sure as hell. And yes, I'm counting Arnold, but in like a different way. Like, no, yeah. I guess he didn't wrestle. He only bodybuilded. It's someone who lived in states with two men who posed in their muscles in small pants. How's
yeah,
that?
That's true. Yeah, that's also great.
And who are both in the Predator.
And yes. Both in Predator. I'm sure that was a tie. I also am from White Bear Lake, home of Jumpin' Jim Brunzel, whose kids went to school with me, and his son, Jim Brunzel III, is like a deep festival person. I was on the outskirts of this world. I just wasn't using terms like sportatorium.
Yeah. It's all good. So Danielle, you called this episode before the movie was even released. So why were you so excited to see this movie?
So I've been, for folks who don't know me, who is everyone, hi, I'm Danielle. So I have been a huge wrestling fan for like most of my life. I've been watching it for almost as many decades as I've been alive. And so usually there have always been talks of them doing different kinds of wrestling movies. They were going to do a Vince McMahon biopic, but he was going to be involved, which means I don't want to see it. They were going to do a Hulk Hogan biopic, but he was going to be involved, which means I don't want to see it. And so this was one of those. This is a legendary story. This is a story that folks know back from like old school Southern wrestling, like Mid-South, back in the territory days before WWF and all that stuff, or like kind of around the same time. This was one where it's you get to see a mostly unvarnished actual look at this family and what happened in this family. Now, this movie, there's so much happening with the Von Erichs that they had to cut some of the tragedies out. Like some of them,
they had to cut a Von Erich out.
They had to cut. They just wasn't room. There just wasn't room in their sad Wrestle Boy movie. And then they were also very, I think they went very easy on Fritz Von Erich. And for most people who've seen the movie, they you will not agree. They went very easy on Fritz Von Erich, possibly because of Kevin, who is still with us, him being kind of involved in like some consulting on the movie. And so I've been excited to see this. I've been, I'm always pumped for any kind of media that shows like the heart of wrestling and why people understand wrestling. And so while I do think that wrestling isn't the villain of the movie, toxic masculinity is, but it just is. And But this also, like, that scene where he's explaining, Kevin is explaining wrestling and how the belts work and how the show works. I was like, okay, great. Like, we got that out of the way for all the people who are like, this is fake and you understand why people love it so much. And just to watch it be, I joke about how silly it is, and it is. It's incredibly silly. But it is also an art form, and all art forms are silly in some places. And so to watch the subject matter be taken seriously, because so... Man, there used to be so many tragic wrestler stories that, you know, for a while, Deadspin was running something called, like, Dead Wrestler of the Week. Like, there were things because, and now, you know, wrestling has, because they were forced to after what happened with Chris Benoit in the 2000s, they were forced to come to a reckoning with how they deal with the health of the people who come through this industry. But before then, it was, you know, there's some tragic stories behind that. And so Dark Side of the Ring from Vice was one place that really took those stories seriously, and it's good to see something where it is like an Oscar caliber movie that is discussing this thing that I love, which is both very serious and incredibly silly.
Yes, indeed. So I know that, you know, once the movie was announced, I looked up the Von Erichs, and we know Danielle did, but did either of you know the history of the Von Erich family before this film?
I knew a little just from having lived in Dallas. Like, I moved there in 1989, yeah. So... kind of after their glory days for the most part, but it was a name that I'd heard bandied about. And, you know, Danielle, when you mentioned the sort of back when wrestling was regional, I grew up where Live Atlanta Wrestling was a very big deal on local TV on basically Ted Turner's channel.
Yes, it
on
was.
Channel 17, which was the UHF station, which would become TBS, basically. Mm-hmm. But early on, one of their staples in between Braves games and Beverly Hillbillies reruns was Live Atlanta Wrestling.
Always 5 minutes late for no good reason.
My brother and I used to rent the pay-per-view Royal Rumble every year. Like, I remember having, like, youthful viewing of it, but I didn't hear about the Von Erichs until this film was announced. I thought it was a really interesting follow-up for Sean Durkin, the director, and to find out he was an enormous fan of theirs, I think that kind of really colors it in positive ways, because he was going after a lot of what Danielle's talking about, this really interesting, you know, duality of being very serious in an art form and a intensely physically demanding thing that's also coded in silliness. But I didn't know them, but it was either Danielle or BJ Colangelo tweeted when this came out about, like, oh man, people are going to think this is a fun, like, sports movie, and they're going to be so, and I was like, what's that? And so I went and spoiled it, and I actually read, there's a great article in Texas Monthly about Kevin Von Erich, the remaining Von Erich, who's played by Zac Efron in this, with, we could do a whole second thing about my issues with male wigs in cinema.
Girl, and we got them.
Wigs on white men. I'm like, what? I don't understand why it's done so well elsewhere.
And here's my only thing about it, specifically when talking about this movie. They spent months building those bodies. You could not get a haircut. You couldn't just be in the gym and just let that hair grow out. Like, to me, I was like, the time it takes to get as built as Zach got, bulk, put on that mass, pump that.
He's enormous.
Like, yeah. Like, you know, I see why, you know, Jeremy Allen White, you know, he's probably filming The Bear, so that's a little more tricky. But, like, I was looking at that wig and I was like, this reminds me of the wig from Dexter that he put on to show that he was younger.
Yeah, but they're spirit Halloween all the way with the wigs.
It's a full Prince Valiant on Efron.
It's bad. I didn't realize they made white boy shake and go wigs, like the kind that you get in the beauty supply right? store, but apparently they do. And Zach went and got one, and that's why he looks like a He-Man figure.
Oh, he fully does. I'll
shake
say,
it after you take it out of the box, you know.
Yeah. he fully, it's, it was his biceps work for that day, was shaking the wig. He does have a beautiful performance in this, and I really, I appreciated all the brothers, but both the parents as well. It's Maura McTierney.
Maura Tierney.
Thank you, Maura McTierney. I really wanted, and it's Holt McTierney.
McElhenney.
Thank you. That's where I was doing it wrong. But the whole cast is giving some really beautiful work. The guys have such a fantastic rapport, and I very much appreciated, especially looking them up. They did not look like these guys, and we also have like literally like a foot and a half difference between Jeremy Allen White and Harris Dickinson. And it doesn't matter. Like, what you're supposed to get from them is this intensity, this commitment, the demons, and then their love and affection for each other. And I was like, oh, if my chemistry reads here are between these brothers, that really pays off. And I think Zac Efron, as the anchor of this, is an unusual choice. I mean, he's someone who obviously there's, I'm sure, some parallels you could draw in terms of, oh, pressures early on and being the center of attention, and then also wanting to be seen in a different way and to be the to be the leading man. But he really brings, I think, a lot of unique vulnerability to something. As Danielle said, the crux of this is you're looking at, oh, this is toxic masculinity as black and white as it gets, right? Of this is how these boys were tasked to live their lives. And when, you know, the first command you're getting is, oh, there's no crying, not even in baseball, there's no crying in funerals, but yeah. Also, you know, just that again, to the alienation of them as well. It's a lot going on. Yeah. And yeah, it's why it's a unique sports film too.
I gotta say, this movie didn't work for me, and I was really surprised, because I'm a big fan of Sean Durkin's previous films, especially including, I should say, The Nest, which I feel like kind of came and went and a lot of people didn't notice it. But I didn't feel like they really built characters for these guys to play. It just sort of, that we kind of, I felt like we were sort of rushing through to these tragedies that we were getting to. I think there's a whole mental health dimension here that isn't being explored at all. I was talking to somebody this weekend. I was like, this should kind of be the dad story, because he's the villain of the piece and is the prime mover of everything here. And everybody else is sort of like trapped into these things that he kind of puts them into. And because we have this surviving brother who I'm sure was essential to getting the film made, he becomes the focal point, but his path and all this is not as interesting as the other ones. And then you have these moments where, like, I don't want to spoil it, but there's a hard turn into magical realism in a film that's been very, very like naturalistic to that point, where I was like, what? Sorry, go ahead.
No, I have to, there were people in the theater who thought that was what the movie was. And they were like, I liked The Wrestler because it was more real. I didn't like that this was a fantasy. And I was like, what an interesting read. Anyway, sorry, continue.
Anyway, but the thing is, like, you know, I Christy and I reviewed this on Breakfast All Day when it came out, and we got all these really angry comments, because, like, as though we weren't taking wrestling seriously because we didn't like this movie. And it's like, this has nothing to do with what I think about actual pro wrestling. This movie, I don't think, is effective at what it's setting out to do as a story, as a tragedy, as a family story. I don't think it delivers on what it could have done. And it is one of those things where I almost wish, like, either make the documentary, or like make we change the names enough to not get sued so that we can really, like, not be tethered to reality, which I think, you know, probably would have benefited NIAID too. But that's another story for another episode. Yeah.
And, you know, this, I felt on the other side of the spectrum, where it did work for me, because I think there's two main reasons that we're not going to focus on the dad. One, because he is a very real piece of shit, and his very real son, who thinks he's a very real piece of shit, consulted on the movie. And two, the dad felt like one part of the problem. I feel like the mom was also part of that problem. I think this was a very great display of family trauma. This will remind me a lot of, I mean, maybe like my Nigerian and Southern upbringing, where sometimes you add superstition to very real treatable issues. Mm-hmm. And I think that the way that it was playing the idea of this curse, which has been like kind of socially accepted for anyone who knows about this story, and not the fact that there was a patriarch in this family who was pushing all of his sons to carry out his dreams. And because he was not looking at his sons as actual kids and looking at them as tools and disposable in the way that he moved, like, it it just makes the whole family crumble. And I think, yeah, I do think that in the pacing of it, once it felt like, you know, once one kid died, now we're just running through. But just even when you look at it, that's how it felt. It felt like, damn, these kids were dropping like flies. And I think that the quickness of it made it feel stronger for me, because I was like, oh yeah, this was like a tragedy, and we see who's at the end of the tragedy. I mean, the fact that, like, the dinner after the funeral, and he's talking about who's going to replace him, and you know it was very hit. So when it got to the point of this Styx River kind of imagination of it, to me it worked, because it was such a high stressor for the last son that I imagine I didn't look at it as this was a fantasy. I was looking at it as like this was him thinking that's what happened. Especially since it came after reading that suicide note. So that's how I translated it. I was like, oh, this is we are in his head and seeing what he's seeing.
And we've also seen him be such a sweet, simple dum-dum. And of course, that's what he's imagining.
He's so simple. He's so nice.
Yeah.
He's,
bless him. Bless him. He's like, I'll feed the kids. Like, good-hearted, sweet little dum-dum. But to me, I was like, yes, that is exactly the comforting image that he would come up with, is what I look at. And I'm like, man, that's really some on-the-nose elementary school reasoning of the afterlife. But okay, oh, that is what this guy would see. I think I'm splitting the difference between the two of you in, I found this movie successful and it stayed with me in ways that were unexpected. I thought I would just sort of see it with my dad, listen to how bummed out I bummed, you know, got him over Christmas. Thanks for that. And then kind of move along. But I've thought of it since then. But I do agree with Alonzo. There's so much story there. And it is the very rare instance where I was like, this is something that could have handled the limited series treatment. Sure. Like an mm-hmm. 8 episode with all of these brothers where you get a little more time at their heyday. You get an episode on each brother.
Including the missing one.
Exactly. That's what I mean. Like, even the one we didn't see, and honestly, even the one that passed away as a kid, you could start there and do more depth than where the parents are coming from, because you know this is real. So my desires to know more about them are almost increased because of that, because I know that they are real people. Sure. Like the Jeremy Allen White brother, Chris?
Carrie.
Carrie, thank you. Yep. Sorry. Chris is the one who didn't make it to the film. Carrie, like, I was like, oh, we just sort of got that guy was going to be an Olympian in a different sport. He did a whole thing. There's the most insane reveal, a visual reveal of him that I'm like, come again? Like, that's the kind of thing that I was like, I would very much like to get in that guy's head for a while, because they are so rich and interesting.
I loved it, but I think it definitely is. It reminds me a lot of like Boogie Nights, where you do the first half is the up and then the second half is the down. And so with this, I almost, because I agree, you didn't get into each individual brother. Each brother was kind of, except for Kevin, who got to be a full character, partially because it's also like, I mean, obviously you don't want to call him the fail son, but that's what the movie calls him, kind of. So we'll go ahead and stick with that. But it does feel as though it treats the relationship with the brothers as a character more than it does each individual brother, who is only known as their specific tragedy. And in some ways, I think that works a lot with some of the dreamier moments. You know, there's a great party scene where you get sort of some of that dreaminess. There are a lot of great scenes like where they're just being brothers and being bros. And it reminds me of, this is such a weird thing, but if you ever have gone to get couples counseling or relationship therapy, the thing that the therapist will tell you is the two of you individually are not my client. The relationship is the client. And so for me, it kind of feels like the relationship between the brothers is the main character of the movie. And whether or not that works for you, again, that's a your mileage may vary. Me, I come in with already like a full depth of knowledge. And so for me, I don't need any help filling in the blanks. But for someone who's genuinely interested in this story, you know, that it could be the difference between a Sackler movie and a Sackler miniseries.
What would you recommend?
Or you could
recommend...
do Fall of Usher and then just again do the one where you ain't got to pay nobody.
What would you recommend for people who want to know more about the Von Erichs, whether or not they've seen this movie? Is there like a doc or a book or anything you would send them to?
Well, the great thing about wrestling is that so much of it gets recounted. There's almost like a very deep storytelling tradition. I believe there is a Dark Side of the Ring about the Von Erichs. If there is, go ahead and look that up. But I like literally, if you can get onto any podcast with some of these old school guys, you wanted something with a Jerry Jarrett, who is who they wound up selling. They're Dallas. I can't remember exactly the name of this, but they wound up going to like a WCW. There are these great podcasts where you can hear like Jeff Jarrett, his kid, talking. You can hear like Bruce Prichard, like a lot of these old school dudes, because unfortunately, one thing we have a lot of is because WWE is the winner of that war. They basically came in and Walmarted everything, and just everything became WWE, whereas before it was like these kind of separate territories. Is that they get to make a lot of the most popular documentaries. Everything is kind of very WWE focused. It can be really difficult to go back and find really powerful pieces that touch on the era before Vince McMahon Sr. or around the time things were happening when Vince McMahon Jr. took it over. So most of that good stuff you're going to find in podcasts. And so and a lot of great people, I would just say, or anything like, you know, if a Jim Ross is talking about it, I would say more you want to hear like the stories from the people who were actually there, because there aren't really, you know, for me at least, that's how I've always done my learning when it comes with wrestling, is you got to like go back, because all those dudes have those podcasts, and you know, they're all selling Blue Chew and other things that I have occasionally sold on my own wrestling podcast, and keep sending them. Not the Blue Chew, but we'll take that too.
And there is a Dark Side of the Ring on the Von Erichs.
Okay.
Yeah, they do. The Dark Side of the Rings do an amazing job. And I think a lot of us were kind of scared because they started working more directly with WWE. But it seems like that's not going to wind up being a problem now, especially with Vince gone.
And Marissa's going to link to that in the show notes, so I will check that out.
That's the one I'm looking forward to now that Vince has got out-carnied, and I could talk about that for years. But Vince has gotten out-carnied the way that he out-carnied everyone else, so that eventual, whatever that's going to be, and that deserves like a miniseries, like a feud-style Ryan Murphy, get in here, it's your time to shine, baby. In 5 years, that's going to be such a good series. Maybe 10. Treat maybe it like the crown.
Maybe just don't let Sean Durkin make it. All right, let's vote, shall we?
Vote.
It's voting time. The way we vote for things on this show is screen it being the highest, stream it being the next highest, and skip it being self-explanatory. Who wants to start?
I'll start. I think I'm kind of a scream it, in that I'm somewhere between skip and stream. I look, nothing but respect for the cast here. They have physically transformed themselves. They are committing to the material. It's the material itself that I don't think is doing justice to either the real life subjects or the people who have been who are working so hard to bring them back to life. But I know that I'm in the minority on this one. So I'd say if you have even a passing interest in professional wrestling history, the Von Erich specifically, you know, this is your chance to sort of see this played out on the big screen. And so I was disappointed, but you know, you may have a better time.
I'm a scream it on the other end, between screen it and stream it. Like I said, there were parts of it that I just wanted more, because I found them so intriguing and so compelling, and there's so much rich texture to what this family went through, and wanting to know each of their different journeys and compulsions. So I did want more from it, but I also very much enjoyed watching it. Enjoy being a tempered word in an instance with a film based on real life people in a family where almost everyone seemed to end their own lives. Please know I'm saying enjoy with all of those caveats, but yeah, I'm a scream it on the other side.
Danielle?
I agree with y'all. My more slightly into details with that would be, yeah, if you're into wrestling, if you're into Jeremy Allen White, which so many of you are right now. I am deep. I get it. I've been into him since Shameless. If you're into, if you're able to see it at the Alamo, I'm not kidding. When they tell you to show up 30 minutes early, they usually do some really special things with their presentations. It is worth going, if nothing else, for like, there's this crazy thing called Steiner Math where someone like breaks down why he's going to win a match in fractions while wearing chainmail and being the buffest dude who can't put his arms down that you've ever seen. It's amazing. Go do that. But if it's something where it's like you want to see it, but you're not super hardcore, then yeah, like stream it. But definitely, I think that this is, I think it's a great movie. It has some really fantastic moments. It is incredibly vulnerable. And I do think that we talk a lot about like kind of, the Andrew Tates and the all of those things and like the products of what some of this is. And being able to actually have a movie that comes out and says like dudes can cry. I know it sounds very 101 in the way that sometimes Barbie was a little feminism 101, but you know what? Sometimes the babies need 101, and maybe sometimes you do need Zac Efron to be like, I can cry, you know, I'm just going to do down the gutters of my huge biceps or like whatever. He's just going to rain down the abs.
We did a whole rant about why the whining about Barbie 101 is silly and unnecessary, because in fact people need 101s. And now look, and a lot of the people, and I'm putting people on notice, a lot of the like film friends I had who was saying that it was 101 definitely didn't see Never Rarely Sometimes Always. So like, don't start beating your chest on feminist movies and why it's not as cool when you ain't even out there supporting the ones that do come out and talk about that next level stuff. Look, I'm always going to be yelling. I'm a stand on business. I think this is a screen it. I think it's a beautiful element of, shining that light on toxic masculinities and like familial trauma that can often be shouldered and blamed on superstition instead of like the person who is like making it happen. And all the pieces of it worked for me. So I was all about it. We're going to take a break to hear from another show for Maximum Fun. But when we come back, we got some more show for you. So don't go anywhere.
The human mind can be tricky. Your mental health can be complex. Your emotional life can be complicated. So it helps to talk about it. I'm John Moe. Join me each week on my show, Depression Mode with John Moe. It's in-depth conversations about mental health with writers, musicians, comedians, doctors, and experts. Folks like Noah Kahn, Sashir Zameda, and Surgeon General Vivek Murthy. We talk about depression, anxiety, trauma, imposter syndrome, and perfectionism. We have the kind of conversations that a lot of folks are hesitant to have themselves. Listen, and you won't feel as alone, and you'll have some laughs, too. Depression Mode for Maximum Fun at MaximumFun.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Maximum Film. I'm your host, Sophie Wadiwe. In the studio with me are
Alonzo Duralde,
Danielle Radford,
Drea Clark.
This week's movie saw some of our favorite actors transformed into beefy wrestlers. Another familiar transformation flows in the opposite direction. Wrestlers turned into actors. So we're going to share some of our favorite examples and performances from actors who got their start in the ring. Who wants to start it off?
I want to reach back a bit to the 50s. Ooh. One of the first of the wrestlers turned actors would be the legendary Tor Johnson. Best known for his work with Ed Wood on movies like Plan 9 from Outer Space and Bride of the Monster, but also appearing in some singularly oddball films like The Beast of Yucca Flats. Not English language, not really his strong suit, but as a physical presence on screen, he definitely stood out.
I feel like there's, to me, there's no talking about this and not talking about sweet, sweet Andre the Giant in The Princess Bride.
Yes. Mm. There we go.
Fezzik. I just love him. He's so wonderful in that. He only knows how to dog paddle. He got the horses. I love him so much. He was definitely of the era of the Clark Family Royal Rumble pay-per-viewing. And he was a very unique screen presence. And I don't remember him doing, I mean, I'm sure he did something else other than that, but The Princess Bride, like, that's an iconic movie to land your wrestling ass in, right?
Yeah, oh, for sure. For sure.
Yeah.
For me, I'm going to go with Roddy Roddy Piper and They Live.
Yeah.
They Live, it's a classic for a reason. Piper is fantastic in it. He was always known for being a great talker, you know. Every time they think they have the answers, I change the questions. Like, he's such a great, he's good on the mic. He's good in that movie. It's obviously, aside from the glasses and the Obey and all the stuff that everybody already knows, really long fight scenes. It's a really good time. Go watch They Live if you have not seen They Live.
He came here to chew gum and kick ass, and he's all out of chewing gum.
He's all out of chewing gum.
Yes, I mean, baby. It's so good. I love that movie anyway. Go watch it. So good.
Yeah.
What about Hell Comes to Frogtown?
Oh, yeah. Yes.
I mean, yeah, you know, I'm going to go for the obvious, and I've said it before in this pod, and I'll say it again, but John Cena, Trainwreck, Blockers, Suicide Squad, yep. Peacemaker.
He's so good.
Fast and Furious 9 as Dom's brother. But like the reason Cena is my favorite is the levels between it, because when you have like Dwayne The Rock Johnson, who's known for being a badass, and then he goes on to be a badass, same for Roddy Piper and most other guys. Mm-hmm. John Cena was, you know, a baby face, which in the wrestling world means he's a super good guy, like built for kids. He started off kind of like a heel when he did that weird white guy rapping bit. And there was a lot of like weird stuff there. But like at his peak, he was like a kid's, like basically a Saturday morning cartoon character, and to see him go into something like, you know, Trainwreck and Peacemaker, where he plays a super dirty kind of actor. It made it even more funny. And then on top of that, he is someone who like genuinely likes it. Like he enjoys all the roles. He loves to embody it. I think the next level beyond that is someone like Dave Bautista, who wants to known as an actor more than a wrestler, and tries to push himself beyond that, even when he kind of stumbles into things like Knock at the Cabin Door.
I heard he was good in that. I didn't see it. Obviously, Dwayne The Rock Johnson is the glaring, you know, we're not going to leave that one on the table.
That's the one everyone aspires to be, I think.
Yeah. But I'd say, like, with those three guys in particular, they have very much, it's fascinating, they've put their sights on being actors, and that's what they're like concentrating on, yet they're all like, oh, I will remain huge. You're just going to have to find reasons for these characters. Like, Bautista's in a Bond film, and he's like, don't worry about it. I'm enormous.
I mean, and Cena, I think they originally tried to put into some sort of generic action movies, and it didn't take.
The Marine,
and then
maybe.
He was like, all right, fine, fuck it. I'm going to be funny. And thankfully, he is.
With Bautista, I'm going to go ahead and say, like, he's going to be our first wrestler that ever wins an Oscar. If a wrestler wins an Oscar or an Emmy, it's going to be Bautista, because Bautista, like, he wants it. He's like, he cares. I already did it. Yeah. I did it. He's like, I don't want to be the big dumb guy. I don't want to do any more things where I'm just like big and dumb. Like, I want to play other roles. Put me in a rom-com. That man is going to win. It'll probably be like a special guest Emmy or something, but he's going to win. He's going to get one of the biggies.
That he would do the Blade Runner sequel, and like, I'm going to be in one scene, but damn it, I'm in the Blade Runner sequel.
Yes.
I'm wearing glasses. Like, it's like, all right, David.
I loved him.
Yeah, I loved him in Knives Out. Like, he has interesting choices. You know who's not going to get an Oscar for acting? Bless her heart, Ronda Rousey. I just remember her rolling up in Furious 7 and me being like, isn't it fun when they struggle over a word? Oh, bless.
She was awful in Entourage. Mm. She was terrible in, she was terrible in, what's that one?
Expendables 3.
Expendables 3. Thank you, babe. Yeah,
I feel bad bringing the only woman into this and just dogging on her.
She's actually one of the more natural presences in the Entourage movie.
It's
going to shock you, but I missed that motion picture.
Look, I know you feel bad about it, but just remember that China was amazing in Third Rock from the Sun.
That's true.
You know, there's another lady.
I really thought you were going to bring up a sex tape. And I was like, amazing?
Third
Rock from the Sun. Good for you,
it's so
China.
Funny because I love me some China. And, you know, as like the king of sex positivity, I wish we could celebrate her sex tape, but then like it came at a time where men were weird and slut-shaming, and she was already in a male-dominated industry, and it just, like, fucked her shit up, and she couldn't, like, she was, like, right before the Kim Kardashian, Kris Jenner train learned how to be like, no, we're going to take power over this and fuck you. Look, if we start on me starting on men and their weird fucking relationship to porn that they heavily ingest but hate if anyone, like, actually enjoys taking it, we would be here forever. So we're going to also mention Stacey Keibler.
Yeah. How I Met Your Mother. Also did George very Lopez well show. On Dancing with the Stars.
Mm-hmm. Is that the person that Fighting with My Family was about, or is that somebody else?
No, that is Paige.
She's the one that dated George Clooney. That's the only reason I know her.
Yes, Keibler dated George Clooney. Paige has done a couple of movies, but they were mostly, like, I think WWE productions. Becky Lynch is also very good. She did that The Rock TV show where she played Cindy Lauper. And that was pretty
great. Oh, and let's not forget Goldberg in Santa's Sleigh.
Oh, never. We can never. Or Kevin Nash. He was, wasn't he one of the Sabretoods or something? He's been,
Magic Mike 1 and 2. Magic Mike.
And then, you know, Drea's favorite mayor or governor, Jesse Ventura, was in The Predator. You know, we mentioned that earlier, so.
Had a couple of crossovers, man.
Jesse the Body. Yeah.
And I just did a whole Flophouse episode about Hulk Hogan and Santa with Muscle. So.
Oh, Lord. God, I haven't seen that before.
A dreadful Santa film, let muscles. Me warn you, but the episode's fun.
It's rough.
Wow, that was a pretty extensive list. Shout
out to us. We did it!
Yeah, all right, well... let's go ahead and move on to staff picks. It could be any movie at all. Who wants to start?
Speaking of wrestlers and Santa, because this is my area of expertise and I don't care that it's January, I want to recommend the documentary I Am Santa Claus, which features is about the process by which people become professional Santas, most notably Mick Foley.
Yep.
AKA Mankind, who is now apparently very happily a professional Santa and super into it, and is one of the fascinating subjects of this documentary. You can watch it on Pluto TV and my favorite Tubi.
Cute. Ooh.
I love Tubi. I want to get paid to write one of their, like, stolen from the headline movies where, like, where the title is, like, very much in it. Like the one that they did, what was it, like, the nurse that saw the baby on the highway? Yeah, I want to write one of those.
A Deadly Dilf, I think, is one I saw recently.
Yes. Oh, my God.
Hire me,
well,
TV.
We'll manifest that for you. Mine is an absolute counter-programming to the Iron Claw. There's zero connective thread here, but it was an unexpected... Oh, that's fun, and I think people could enjoy it. It's a little film, a Chinese film called Miss Shampoo, that is currently on Netflix by Giddens Co. If you've watched his other stuff, you'll know he has an interesting hybrid style, action, whatever. This is a rom-com about a gangster and a hairdresser's apprentice, and she sort of kind of accidentally saves his life. And then they fall for each other, and he keeps sending in his, like, his gang so she can practice hair on them. And she is terrible at it. but it has some unique twists to it as well, that he's sort of the gooier, like, very smitten character, and she has some more steely depth. So yes, the first half, super charming. The second half gets a little like, this is going unexpected places. But I found it really fun. I like things that are taking on interesting threads. So there you go. Miss Shampoo. If you want something unique that nobody else is watching.
So Beyond the Mat is a great wrestling documentary. But I also want to talk about because of all of my 80 different kinds of jobs being on strike last year, I didn't get to talk about a lot of the cutesy movies I wanted to talk about. So I want to take this opportunity to talk about how everyone should see Red, White, and Royal Blue. It is an adorable little rom-com. It is so corny. And I mean that in the best way, because, like, queers deserve corny too. We deserve to have the corniest rom-coms that y'all can find as well. And this one is so delightfully corny. And then it gets, like, super sexy, where you're like, oh, I thought this was going to be Hallmark, but now it's like, ooh, oh my. So it does get but it is, I don't know. I just thought it was great, and it's super cute, and it goes down real easy. Like, if you're having a bad day and you just want, like, a mental weighted blanket hug from a movie, that is what Red, White, and Royal Blue will be for you. Just a fun, just back when we made rom-coms, just look at it. And it's enemies to lovers, come on. All the tropes, it's so tropey.
The best subgenre.
It is so tropey, but yeah. No, I've always said like that, that's when true parody will be achieved, when we get a you know, Hallmark movie that is as sexless and dull about a same-sex couple that we do about, you know, like a straight couple. And yeah, you're right. This movie is like completely cornball, but it's still queer, and why not?
Yes, indeed. And, you know, and after you listen to that, come listen to the episode we did on it. It'll be a good time. But yeah, for my staff pick, it's time for another illustrious multi-week staff pick. And, you know, and I don't give a damn if this is everyone's staff pick going forward. I finally saw Godzilla Minus Zero, and exactly like I thought it would be my movie of the year, it was. And I do love the poetry that is it coming out the same year as, I'm sorry, yes, Godzilla Minus One. That's the next one is Minus Zero. Godzilla Minus One. It is just the poetry of it coming out the same year as Oppenheimer. And to me, I looked at it as a reclamation of, you know, the original kind of like allegory of Godzilla kind of makes it this atom bomb thing. And now in Minus Zero, it's about, you know, the mindset that did I say Minus Zero again?
Yes, you did.
Okay. In Minus One. See, this is why I failed math. Minus, because you can't minus zero. That doesn't make sense.
You can. It just doesn't do anything.
You can't divide by zero.
Okay. Well, I didn't make it to that one. Minus One. Is, you know, kind of making it about, you know, just the philosophy of battle that the Japanese had in World War II, and just how like mired, you know, culturally Japan is in the idea of honor and duty, no matter how much it affects, you know, those who are forced to be under that weight. So I truly, yeah, I agree with everything Alonzo said when he picked it as a staff pick. It is a terrifying version.
And it was on my top 10 of the year.
And your top 10.
It's so good.
A terrifying version. I cried. Everything and more.
It just, I like the goofy, I love me a goofy old school Toho Godzilla. Love it. Give me creepy twins rising up out of the ocean in a clamshell. Like, give me robot Godzilla. Give me all that stuff. But this
glam
was,
aliens.
Yes. Give me all, God, that one is so funny. Give me all those old school wild ones. This is my favorite of the takes Godzilla serious Godzilla movies. And obviously, like, the American ones, we count all those separately. And I count I also count the legendary ones separately from all the other one American ones too. Godzilla's you actually do have to think about quite a few things when you're talking about a Godzilla movie, I guess. But yes, for the movies where it like takes Godzilla seriously, easily my favorite. Rocketed up to the top, like no competition. Minus One is an amazing movie. Probably top five of last year.
Ooh, yes. All right. Well, thank you so much to Danielle Radford. What Yay! Do you want the listeners to know about?
And we're throwing a chair at you right now.
That's Danielle Radford's music. Find us, Tights and Fights. We have new episodes that come out every, I believe those come out every Saturday. Julian, don't kill me. If you want to hear more about wrestling, or if you like wrestling and you're like, I didn't know that y'all had a wrestling podcast, we do. And it's very, very goofy, and it's a lot of me just getting these jokes off. So sorry. Also, speaking of staff picks, I have a show with Cracked. It's about once a week, but we are doing kind of seasons. So we're taking a couple months off, and then we'll be back in a couple of months, where our goal right now is we're just trying to pick like the best staff pick shelf for a video store of our dreams. So go and make sure that you check that out. That's over on the Cracked YouTube channel. It's called Staff Picks. Yeah, and I think that's it. Everything else, just find me on my Twitters. It's just Danielle Radford. I'm still there. I'll be there until we burn it down. So just find me on there. And I guess if y'all just tell me where we're going and who all's gonna be there, I'll show up. Are we going to Blue Sky? What are we doing? Just tell me who's gonna be there. Yeah, just tell me who's gonna be there.
Dre and Alonzo, thank you for another wonderful show.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Yes. And you, listener, thank you for listening. If you have a comment or suggestion about this week's show, send us an email at MaximumFilm@MaximumFun.org or find us on any of our social media channels. All those links are in the show notes. Next week, we're going to be talking about The Color Purple. Our producer is Marissa Flaxbart. Our senior producer is Laura Swisher. And this is a production of Maximum Fun. Bye-bye.
Maximum Fun, a worker-owned network
of artist-owned shows,
supported
directly
by you.